Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, May 30th. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. Main headline on the front page is Officer Charged as Riots Roil Minneapolis. The white Minneapolis police officer who pressed his knee into George Floyd's neck was arrested Friday and charged with murder as authorities imposed overnight curfews to try to stem violent protests over police killings of African Americans that have spread from Minneapolis and other U.S. cities. Protesters smashed windows at CNN headquarters in Atlanta, set a police car on fire, and struck officers with bottles. Large protests in New York, Houston, and other cities were largely peaceful, even in Minneapolis, where thousands marched downtown as the city's 8 p.m. curfew ticked past and encircled a police precinct station. "Prosecute the police," some chanted, and "Say his name, George Floyd." There was no violence, but some protesters sprayed graffiti on nearby buildings. Elsewhere in the city, forces fired tear gas and rubber bullets to drive back crowds of protesters. It wasn't clear whether or how authorities would enforce the curfew amid sharp questions about city and state leaders mishandling the crisis. The curfew came one night after protesters burned a police precinct station, and barriers were erected around at least two police precincts before nightfall. Derek Chauvin, age 44, was charged with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. He also was accused of ignoring another officer who expressed concerns about Floyd as he lay handcuffed on the ground, pleading that he could not breathe as Chauvin pressed his knee into his neck. Floyd, who was black, had been arrested on suspicion of using a counterfeit bill at a store. Chauvin, who was fired along with three other officers who were at the scene, faces more than 12 years in prison if convicted of murder. An attorney for Floyd's family welcomed the arrest, but said he expected a more serious murder charge and wants the other officers arrested. Prosecutor Mike Freeman said more charges are possible, but authorities felt it appropriate to focus on the most dangerous perpetrator. Meanwhile, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey declared a curfew from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. Friday and Saturday, with exceptions for emergency responders, the homeless, and those seeking medical care. "I know that whatever hope you feel today is tempered with skepticism and a righteous outrage," Frey said in a statement. "Today's decision from the county attorney is an essential first step on a longer road toward justice and healing our city." Protests also spread across the U.S., fueled by outrage over Floyd's death and years of police violence against African Americans. Demonstrators clashed with officers in New York and blocked traffic in Houston and San Jose, California. In Atlanta, demonstrators jumped on police cruisers, set one police car ablaze, and broke windows at CNN's headquarters, where hundreds of people were confronting police. On Monday, police were trying to put Floyd in a squad car when he stiffened and fell to the ground, saying he was claustrophobic, a criminal complaint said. Chauvin and officer Tao Tho arrived and tried several times to get the struggling Floyd into the car. At one point, Chauvin pulled Floyd out of the car's passenger side, and Floyd, who was handcuffed, went to the ground face down. Officer J.K. Kuhn held Floyd's back, and Officer Thomas Lane held his legs, while Chauvin put his knee on Floyd's head and neck area, the complaint said. When Lane asked whether Floyd should be rolled onto his side, Chauvin said, "No, staying put is where we got him." Lane said he was worried about excited delirium or whatever. An autopsy said the combined effects of being restrained, potential intoxicants in Floyd's system, and his underlying health issues, including heart disease, probably contribute to his death. It revealed nothing to support strangulation as the cause of death. There were no other details about intoxicants, and toxicology results can take weeks. In the 9/11 call that drew police, the caller describes a man suspected of paying with counterfeit money as awfully drunk and he's not in control of himself. After Floyd apparently stopped breathing, Lane again said he wanted to roll Floyd onto his side. Kuhn checked for a pulse and said he could not find one, according to the complaint. In all, Chauvin had his knee on Floyd's neck for 8 minutes 46 seconds, including nearly 3 minutes after Floyd stopped moving, the complaint said. Chauvin's attorney had no comment when reached by the Associated Press. Freeman defended himself against questions about why charges weren't brought sooner, saying his office needed to gather evidence, and noted the extraordinary speed in bringing charges only 4 days after Floyd's death. It was not immediately clear whether Chauvin's arrest would quiet the unrest, which escalated again Thursday night as demonstrators burned a Minneapolis police station. Next, we have close to God, distant from each other. Eastern Iowa churches welcome back worshipers. After 2.5 months of meeting virtually, Antioch Christian Church in Marion is ready to welcome its 1,900 attendees to worship in person June 7th. The building has been sterilized and scrubbed down, Pastor Greg Johnson said. Every other row in the sanctuary has been blocked off, and people will be asked to leave 3 seats between themselves. As Christians, we prayed about it for a long time, Johnson said. There comes a time when people, being social creatures, need to get back together and long to get back together. We feel the time is right, and as people feel comfortable, church attendance will continue to build. Governor Kim Reynolds issued a proclamation April 29th, no longer prohibiting in-person spiritual and religious gatherings. Churches, synagogues, and other religious organizations still must ensure social distancing, increased hygiene practices, and other health measures to reduce the risk of a transmission of the coronavirus, she ordered. At the time, many religious leaders across Iowa questioned the governor's decision to so soon permit in-person religious gatherings, even under the social distancing guidelines. However, a month later, churches have established social distancing guidelines for their buildings, enhanced cleaning routines, and modified services to allow people to worship together in person and hopefully prevent the spread of COVID-19. As Antioch reopens, it plans to hold children's Sunday school, meeting with no more than 10 children per room, Johnson said. Crayons have been removed, markers will be cleaned after use, and surfaces will be routinely cleaned to prevent the spread of germs, he said. When children are dropped off at Sunday school by their parents, volunteers will watch to see if a child is coughing or otherwise possibly sick, Johnson said. Symptoms of the virus can appear between 2 and 14 days after exposure to COVID-19, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. When asked if he was concerned about asymptomatic children spreading the coronavirus in Sunday school, Johnson said, I don't know how to answer that. We're going to trust the Lord for the rest of it. We can only do our part. The Archdiocese of Dubuque announced this month that parishes would be able to begin gathering for Mass again starting today and Sunday. The Reverend Philip Thompson, with St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, who is a member of the Archdiocese of Dubuque's Priest Council, said he was surprised by the news. Certainly, I have mixed feelings, Thompson said. I know people have missed receiving Holy Communion during these last 2.5 months. They're anxious to get back to be able to do that, and that the risk of the virus is still very present. The church really requires us to participate fully in the Eucharist, and we can't do that by sitting at home and watching it on a computer screen. St. Pius X is resuming Mass at 4:30 p.m. Saturdays and at 8:30 and 10:30 a.m. Sundays. Every other pew has been marked off, and people who do not live in the same household will be asked to keep 6 feet of distance between themselves and others. Everyone at St. Pius X, who is 2 years and older, will be required to wear a mask. People are welcome to come up and accept communion, but only the bread will be offered, not the wine normally shared from a communal cup. Thompson said the church, which is able to seat 850, will seat only about 400 for now with social distancing. If the church is at capacity, greeters will turn people away at the door. Thompson readily admits that if there is a spike in the number of COVID-19 cases in Linn County, the church will shut down again. First Assembly of God in Cedar Rapids plans a soft opening Sunday. About 200 regular attendees receive tickets to test its social distancing and sanitizing protocols. The sanctuary will have limited seating, providing only 30% of normal capacity, and the church has added a third service. No children's ministries are being offered at this time, and families will sit together. People will not be required to wear masks, but wearing one is more than welcome, First Assembly Pastor Brian Pingle said. We're going to outdo each other in showing honor, Pingle said. We're encouraging grace and love. People are ready to connect with each other and be in each other's presence. We're going to trust people to be adults. Let's see. Next, we have Iowa start sending aid to residents and merchants. CARES funds also headed to farmers and rural hospitals. Iowa will begin allocating $700 million in federal coronavirus relief funds to help residents and businesses cope with the economic impact of the pandemic, including rent and mortgage assistance to Iowans at immediate risk of eviction or foreclosure. Governor Kim Reynolds' plan calls for using most of the state's $1.25 billion in Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, or CARES, Act funds to help small businesses and support K-12 distance learning, rural hospitals, telehealth, farmers, and ethanol producers. She said she will hold back $550 million as the state monitors the impact of joblessness due to the virus on the unemployment trust fund and for unforeseen COVID-19 expenses, Reynolds said at her daily news briefing Friday. Although she doesn't know how many Iowans will seek foreclosure and eviction assistance, Iowa Economic Development Authority Director Debbie Durham said the program has been designed to accept as many as 20,000 applications. Applications are at iowahousingrecovery.com. Homeowners will be able to receive up to $3,000 in assistance on mortgage payments, and renters are eligible for as much as $3,200 in aid. Payments will be made directly to mortgage holders and landlords, she said. 66 days after Iowa's first COVID-19 death, another 20 fatalities were reported Friday morning, bringing the total to 520, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. There are 5 deaths in Polk County, 4 in Wapello, 3 in Dallas, 2 in Woodbury, and 1 each in Blackhawk, Dubuque, Mahaska, Marshall, Monroe, and Pottawatomie counties. An additional 269 cases reported raised to 18,791, the total number of Iowans who have been infected with the coronavirus. Also, 3,948 tests were conducted, including 2,503 by Test Iowa, the Utah-based company the state hired under a $26 million contract. It's exciting, Reynolds said. The testing has been near capacity for the last 3 days. Reynolds credited fiscally responsible budgeting practices with putting Iowa in a strong financial position before COVID-19 impacted the state. At the end of fiscal 2019, Iowa had a surplus of nearly $300 million. Reserve funds were full, and the labor participation rate was one of the highest in the country. Since then, revenues have slowed, and the unemployment rate has soared. With 13,365 new unemployment claims filed over the past week, there are 180,679 Iowans out of work, according to Iowa Workforce Development. So Reynolds earmarked $215 million to help small businesses reopen and put Iowans back to work and to assist homeowners and renters. Her plans also call for $100 million in aid for farmers as well as ethanol producers, which are operating at 70% capacity. Funds also will support food banks. Another $125 million will go to local governments that have seen revenue decline during forced business shutdowns that have limited receipts from sales, gas, and hotel-motel taxes, while COVID-19-related expenses have increased. To help them begin the recovery process, the aid will cover their 10% of a match required by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Healthcare providers will get $50 million to support substance abuse and behavioral health services, and $85 million will be used to extend access to telehealth, telework, and telelearning. To do that, our state must address broadband capacity and access as well as modernizing our information technology system that is necessary for conducting business, education, healthcare, and life from rural communities to the state capital, Reynolds said. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst joins Reynolds' briefing to talk about the funding Congress has provided in response to the pandemic. That includes more than $5 billion of paycheck protection loans to 54,000 Iowa businesses and $2.7 billion in direct economic assistance payments to 1.7 million Iowans. She said she is working to include more funding for farmers and child care providers in the next round of COVID-19 relief assistance. Next, we have cities helping residents with rent and utilities. Cedar Rapids and Iowa City team up with social service groups. Both Cedar Rapids and Iowa City will work with social service agencies to provide hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal funds to residents facing eviction. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, each city received extra money under the Community Development Block Grant, a longtime federal program for community development focusing on affordable housing and poverty relief efforts. Both communities said they will work with social service agencies to identify those most in need of the aid. The city is allocating $623,757 in additional CDBG funds it got to provide assistance to low and moderate income households. The mayor and city council recognized early on that housing assistance would be a critical need, for many Cedar Rapids residents. During this time, City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said in a statement, "This program will provide direct support to citizens who have been greatly impacted with a loss of income due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The aid will help with rent and utility bills." The announcement came hours before Governor Kim Reynolds announced a statewide program to help renters or homeowners at risk of eviction or foreclosure because of a documented COVID-19 related loss of income after March 17th. That program, run through the Iowa Finance Authority, provides rental assistance for up to 4 months for a maximum of $3,200, or mortgage payment assistance for up to 2 months or a maximum of $3,000. But anyone receiving a $600 a week additional unemployment benefit under the Federal CARES Act is not eligible for the state program. Cedar Rapids Community Development Director Jennifer Pratt said the city will monitor the state aid so resources aren't duplicated. "We do know, for instance, the state program will not assist people who have been receiving unemployment," she said. "Our program allows that. It's always in everyone's best interest to layer resources so they're most effective." In April, the city conducted a survey of registered landlords to get feedback on what issues the landlords were facing due to COVID-19. The results showed that roughly 8% of the reported units were behind on rent. That, according to 43% of the landlords who responded, is an increase in late rent over this time last year. Nearly half reported that they plan to offer a payment plan to tenants instead of proceeding to eviction. Pratt said she expects 800 to 1,200 residents may need rent or utility assistance. "The program is available until funds run out," she said. The city said it will coordinate referrals for the program through local Iowa Legal Aid, Horizons, and other social service agencies. Tracy Heitschuh, the Neighborhood and Development Services Director for Iowa City, said the city received $410,000 and $422,000, $410,422 in additional CDBG funding. 60% of that will go toward preventing evictions in the city and be administered by Community Crisis Services and Food Bank, Heitschuh said. The city is working on finalizing the parameters for the program, and like Cedar Rapids, ensuring it does not duplicate the efforts of the Iowa Finance Authority's program. The Johnson County Courthouse is unlikely to reopen and begin processing evictions until July 13th, giving the city more time to finalize the program, Heitschuh said. "We're going to tweak our program a little bit," she said. Heitschuh said under the city's program, funds will go to the landlord to meet emergency rent or utility needs. Heitschuh said the city council also has approved $50,000 in local funds to fund a bridge program to meet the gap between now and when the federal funds are administered. The other 40% of the additional CDBG funds received by the city will go to nonprofits affected by COVID-19, Heitschuh said. "The city has not yet determined which organization will administer those funds," she said. Iowa residents facing eviction should contact Iowa Legal Aid's COVID-19 Legal Advice Hotline at 1-800-332-0419. Pratt also said anyone who has been given notice of eviction should call Iowa Legal Aid immediately. Many playgrounds will reopen Monday. Cedar Rapids schools to keep their playgrounds closed for now. Many outdoor playgrounds in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City will reopen Monday, in line with Governor Kim Reynolds' proclamation earlier this week. But the Cedar Rapids School District will keep its playgrounds closed for now, with officials saying they will consider the governor's decisions along with advice from the state and county public health officials. The district is closely monitoring the governor's proclamations, and further guidance will be forthcoming by July 1st, 2020, on any modifications to the facility's usage, according to a message sent to families Friday. Likewise, some families are not prepared to let their children swing, slide, and climb on equipment touched by other children. "I'm not quite at the point of being 100% comfortable, especially because there's evidence COVID-19 can live on surfaces," said Clara Delrue Schultz of Iowa City about letting her daughter, Aviana Axton, age 9, play on public playgrounds. The mother and daughter enjoyed ice cream outside Dane's Dairy in Iowa City on Friday, the last day of school for the Iowa City Community School District, after wiping down the table and using hand sanitizer. Playgrounds were closed in March to reduce the spread of COVID-19, a virus primarily spread through close person-to-person contact. The cities of Cedar Rapids, Marion, and Iowa City announced this week they will reopen outdoor playgrounds Monday, although restrooms at some sites will remain closed. Iowa City plans to post signs warning playground users there will not be any increased cleaning of the equipment and they use the playground at their own risk. Cedar Rapids also will have signs at 52 playground sites to remind park users to practice social distancing, stay home if they are ill, and to use hand sanitizer before, during, and after use. The Iowa City School District will open elementary school playgrounds to the public Monday, with spokeswoman Kristen Peterson encouraging everyone to continue to follow CDC and public health guidance regarding social distancing. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said last week it may be possible that a person can get COVID-19 by touching a surface or object that has the virus on it, and then touching their own mouth, nose, or possibly their eyes. This isn't thought to be the main way the virus spreads. There's some evidence ultraviolet rays and sunlight may be able to deactivate viruses like COVID-19, National Public Radio reported. Sam Jarvis, community health manager for the Johnson County Public Health Department, said families should be aware they are assuming additional risks if they go to a park or playground. The reality is, when there are people in an area, it's very natural to want to socialize, especially children, Jarvis said. If one is able to keep their physical distance or be at the park on their own, there's less risk. If the park has many people, it's hard to keep your distance. There's more risk. That might be a time to avoid the park and playground if there are too many people. Bodies found buried in car in Evansdale. The search for a missing Arizona woman and her stepfather appears to have ended on a dead-end road in Evansdale, southeast of Waterloo. Chino Valley, Arizona police on Friday said the remains, believed to be Alyssa Landry, age 28, and her stepfather, David Batten, age 45, of Chino Valley, were discovered inside Landry's Subaru, which was buried in an undeveloped lot on Timber Oak Road. Official confirmation of the identities is pending medical examiner results, police said. Batten and Landry were reported missing around April 19th, along with Landry's boyfriend, Mitchell Allen Minks, age 24, formerly of Waterloo, who was living with family members in Arizona. Minks, age 24, was found April 28th at a rural Blackhawk County home and detained on a federal probation violation. Earlier this week, he was taken from Iowa back to Arizona for a hearing. This week, Chino Valley Police said they received information that evidence relating to the missing person was located at Timber Oak Road, and they notified local law enforcement and sent detectives to Iowa. FBI agents were involved in the search, along with the Blackhawk County Sheriff's Office in Waterloo and Evansdale Police. Evansdale neighbors said police arrived at the one-acre lot, which houses a steel shed and animal pens, on Wednesday. Trailers and light earth-moving equipment could be seen on the property Thursday. On Friday, officers put up tarps to shield the scene from view from the public. Surgeries that require hospital stays to resume next week in Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids medical providers have announced they are entering the next phase of their reopening and soon will allow surgeries that require hospital stays to resume. Starting Monday, previously scheduled surgery cases with post-operative hospital stays will begin at Cedar Rapids' main medical hubs. We will continue to closely monitor the pandemic and will expand the number of procedures available in the coming weeks, eventually returning to the level of pre-pandemic services. If we are able to continue to meet our guiding principles safely, officials said in the Friday news release, this step is the third of four steps in a phased-in approach to resuming healthcare services after the pandemic. The roadmap was first implemented in March by Mercy Medical Center, Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital, Physicians Clinic of Iowa, and Linn County Anesthesiologists, according to the joint news release. As the number of hospital stays related to COVID-19 across the state began to decline, Governor Kim Reynolds allowed elective surgeries to resume in early May. At that time, the Cedar Rapids hospitals and other providers reactivated select surgical services and other invasive procedures, as well as certain outpatient services. Strict measures to mitigate the risk of spread will remain. Patient visitors will continue to be limited, face masks will be required, and all patients and staff will be screened before entering the hospital. In addition, healthcare officials are establishing rigorous cleaning and sanitizing processes and will promote hand hygiene and social distancing. The Cedar Rapids medical providers also are implementing new COVID-19 testing for patients before surgery to ensure that local medical facilities are among the safest of all environments and patients can be fully confident in seeking the care they need. Tyson temporarily closes pork plant in Storm Lake. Tyson Foods has announced it will temporarily close a northwestern Iowa pork plant a day after state health officials revealed that 555 of its more than 2,500 employees had tested positive for COVID-19. The company announced late Thursday in a news release that it would shutter its Storm Lake plant over the next 2 days and stay closed while the plant undergoes deep cleaning and sanitation next week. When operations resume, Team members at Tyson's Storm Lake facility will continue to have access to additional testing, daily clinical symptom screenings, nurse practitioners, and enhanced education through Matrix Medical, which has a mobile unit on site, a Tyson statement said. Buena Vista County, where Storm Lake is located, had 701 positive cases as of Thursday, or 3,527 cases per 100,000 people, the largest concentration of cases in Iowa. Meat processing plants across the country have been hit hard by the coronavirus outbreak, and Tyson has temporarily closed several plants in Iowa, Nebraska, and other states in recent weeks. DNR to deny permit to export water. The Gazette A Northeast Mining Company's request for a permit to draw millions of gallons of water from Iowa's Jordan Aquifer to export to western states will be denied after the company couldn't say why the project would be beneficial to Iowans. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources on May 21st sent Pattison Sand Company, a silica sand mining company near Clayton, a letter stating the DNR planned to deny Pattison a new use permit. The company proposed drilling a new well near the Mississippi River, loading water into tank cars, and selling it to an Oregon company called Watertree, which supplies drought-stricken communities in New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, Wyoming, Utah, and Arizona, the permit application states. Pattison has failed to supply the department with insufficient information regarding the beneficial use of the requested water, Mark Mueller, DNR Water Supply Engineering Supervisor, wrote. Please be aware that the department has other potential concerns regarding the scenario posed in the application, Mueller wrote. However, the department must have enough information to complete its beneficial use investigation before it can determine if those concerns are even valid. This is the third time Pattison has sought permission to export water from Iowa, an idea that concerns some lawmakers and environmentalists, the Des Moines Register has reported. State Senator Rob Hogg, Democrat from Cedar Rapids, said Friday he is glad the DNR has denied Pattison's permit. My primary concern about this is that the water here should be used for Iowans, he said. Hogg said he thinks the Iowa legislature needs to strengthen state laws on use of underground water resources to discourage future applications for exporting water. I trust the DNR to keep denying these permits until we can address it legislatively, he said, adding it would be unlikely to come up in an abbreviated legislative session starting next week. Pattison's April 22nd request was for a permit to drill a new well that would tap the Cambrian Ordovician Aquifer, better known as the Jordan Aquifer, which supplies drinking water to much of Iowa and other Midwest states. The aquifer, which would yield from hundreds to more than 1,000 gallons of water per minute, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, recharges quickly in northeast Iowa, where Pattison wanted its new well. Pattison founder Kyle Pattison told the DNR in an April 22nd application, the millions of gallons of water that would be drawn by the company and sent west wouldn't deplete Iowa's underground water supply because the aquifer at that point drains to the Mississippi River. We have a water resource that has no impact on the state of Iowa's water reserve, and if we can export it, it will have a significant positive impact on jobs and economic activity in northeast Iowa. The company requested a waiver from the legal requirement that permit applications must state how water extracted from underground aquifers would be put to beneficial use. The DNR denied the waiver. Pattison said it was impossible to pinpoint exactly where the water would be used, since Watertree supplies water for dairy, agricultural, industrial, manufacturing, and municipal water needs in several western states, according to Watertree's website. Kyle Pattison did not immediately respond to an email sent Friday. Probe, Trump official misused office. A senior Trump administration official misused his office for private gain by capitalizing on his government connections to help get his son-in-law hired at the Environmental Protection Agency, investigators said in a report obtained by the Associated Press. The Interior Department Inspector General found that Assistant Interior Secretary Douglas Dominic reached out to a senior EPA official in person and later by email to advocate for the son-in-law when he was seeking a job at the agency. Investigators said Dominic also appeared to misuse his position to promote a second family member's wedding-related business to the same EPA official who was engaged at the time. Now you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, May 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Darlene Joan Arthurs. Darlene Joan Arthurs, age 84, of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, May 26, 2020, at home following a short but courageous battle with liver cancer. Services are at 1 p.m. Monday, June 1st at TM Funeral Home. Friends may visit with the family afternoon. Burial is at St. Joseph Cemetery. Darlene is survived by her husband of 64 years, James, sons Jim Wally III of Robbins and Paul of Cedar Rapids, four grandchildren, Jim IV, Mike, and Amy Arthurs and Nathan Noble, and great-grandchild M.J. Arthurs Jr. She was preceded in death by her daughter, Teresa Noble, brother Al, and sisters Bernice and Dorothy. Darlene was born March 10, 1936 in Sioux City, the daughter of Ed and Bertha Jamgar Moskow. She graduated from Sioux City High School, where she was the head majorette and baton twirler. She married James Arthurs on February 10, 1956 in Sioux City. Darlene was a secretary for the Cedar Rapids school system, including Jefferson High School and Truman Elementary, retiring in 2001. Darlene enjoyed reading, playing piano, sketching, and working crossword puzzles. Her favorite television shows were Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune. Darlene liked traveling and took many trips to Florida, New York, and Wisconsin Dells. She loved to take care of children, often praising them, and spending time with her family. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences can be left at www.teahenfuneralhome.com. Brett D. Seltrick. Brett D. Seltrick, age 54, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, May 27, 2020, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha, Iowa. Per his wishes, no services will be held. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Brett was born January 23, 1966, the son of Carl and Karen Seltrick. He grew up in Troy Mills, Iowa, and was a 1984 graduate of Northland High School. Brett participated in baseball, basketball, and football, and was proud to be named Tri-River's first-team all-conference defensive end. He worked as a machinist at Sadler Machine. Brett was a New England's Patriots, Iowa Hawkeyes, and Philadelphia Phillies fan. He frequently sported his Patriots jersey. Brett enjoyed shooting pool, darts, golf, riding his bike, and celebrating the weekend. He was a fan of murder mystery shows. Brett enjoyed long walks with his dog, Edgar. He loved his family and friends very much and always looked out for them. Brett is survived and lovingly remembered by his parents, Carl and Karen Seltrick of Marion, brothers Eric Seltrick of Marion and Bart Seltrick of Waterloo, an aunt, and several uncles and cousins. He was preceded in death by his grandparents and several other family members. The family would like to give a special thanks to the staff at Mercy Hospital and the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy for the care given to Brett and his family. A memorial fund has been established, and memorials in Brett's memory may be directed to the family in care of Murdoch Funeral Home, 3855 Katz Drive, Marion, Iowa, 52302. Please share memory of Brett at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Larry D. Baker passed away at the age of 83 at Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy on Wednesday, May 27, 2020, following an illness with leukemia. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 1st, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, and visitation will start at 10 a.m. Larry Baker graduated from Kyoto High School in 1955. He met his loving wife, Joan Baker, at 36 years old and married on April 18, 1973. Joan passed away after an extended illness with Alzheimer's on December 14, 2013. Larry owned a seed cleaning business in Kyoto for many years. He also worked as a semi-truck driver for approximately 25 years with CRST and GSTC and retired after a long career spent on the road to spend time with his loving family. Larry volunteered at River of Life Church for several years, preparing and delivering food to those in need. Ronald, goes by Ron, James Mavrius, passed away on May 6, 2020 at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in the Cardiovascular Intensive Care Unit, where he worked for many years after a short yet courageous battle with cancer. Per his wishes, no services were held, and he donated his body to the Carver College of Medicine deeded body program for further education and research. Ron was born December 9, 1940 at 8:05 a.m. at St. Luke's Methodist Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He spent his first 20 months at the Iowa Soldiers Orphans Home in Davenport, Iowa, until he was adopted on August 13, 1942 by John and Bernice Maveris. Ron graduated from Bettendorf High School on May 28, 1959. Ron touched many lives as he worked for 42 years at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. Most of those years were spent at the nursing unit clerk in the CVICU. Ron served in the Housing Trust Fund of Johnson County Board of Directors since 2004. He served as secretary and is remembered there as a dedicated and kind volunteer. Ron's closest companion the past several years was his dog, Coco, who died only a few days after Ron passed. Ron is survived and lovingly remembered by special friend Terry Croson and many friends he made over the years living in Iowa City and working at the University of Iowa Hospital. Given Ron's love of animals, please forward any memorials in his honor to the Johnson County Humane Society. Keen Sweet, age 87, of Iowa City, passed away Tuesday, May 26, 2020, at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He was born November 6, 1932, in Wilton, Maine, the son of Charles and Agnes Sweet. Keen married the love of his life, Joan Diane Houston, on August 28, 1954, in Caribou, Maine. He graduated from Wilton Academy and received his bachelor's degree from Tufts University, a master's degree from the University of Colorado, and his PhD from the University of Edinburgh, Scotland. Keen served the U.S. Army from 1955 to 57. The family moved to Iowa City in 1966 after Keen accepted a position as a professor with the Department of Geology, retiring in 1996. His research was instrumental in proving the theory of continental drift in the Northern Hemisphere. Keen had many passions. Family was especially important to him. He enjoyed every opportunity to get the family together, whether it was Hawkeyes football weekends, ski trips, time spent at the cabin in Maine, or adventure travel around the world. His love of outdoors included kayaking, skiing, hiking, camping, and boating. After retirement, he enjoyed spending time in his cabin in Maine, where he continued to pursue his interests. Keen also was very committed to his teaching career and the geology students he taught. His professional accomplishments include multiple grants from the National Science Foundation and many articles in scientific journals. Survivors include his wife, Joan, son Alan Sweat of Johnston, daughter Joanne Sheehan of Stoughton, Wisconsin, grandchildren Michael Shattuck, Kelly Meinholz, Tyler Sweat, and Brandon Sweat, great-grandchildren Skylar, Cody, Jack, and Jude, and a sister-in-law, Kathy Sweat, of Skowhegan, Maine. Keen was preceded in death by his parents and his brother, Carlton. Keen loved exploring national parks. The family wishes memorials be made via the website donate.nationalparks.org in lieu of flowers or plants. Keen chose to be cremated with Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service handling the arrangements. Marie A. Olson, age 91, lifelong resident of the Oxford area, died at her home Monday, May 25, 2020. Private family gravesite services will be held at the Oxford Cemetery. Public memorial services will be held at a later date to be announced. To share a thought, memory, or condolence with her family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandcia.com. Marie Arletta Schropp was born March 21, 1929, near Oxford on the family farm, the daughter of Ernie and Alice Schropp. She was united in marriage to Roy A. Olson on June 30, 1948, in Oxford. The couple resided near Oxford, where they raised their family. For a number of years, Marie worked for the former Scheller Globe Company in Iowa City. She was a collector of antiques, Cupid dolls, enjoyed her roses and rock gardens, but most of all, she loved being with her family and friends throughout the years. Her family includes her three sons and their wives, Alan and Tracy Olson, Mark and Carol Olson, and Clint and Lisa Olson, and Dan Malone, Stephen and Karen Olson, Jason Olson, and Tyler Olson. Those are the grandchildren. and great-grandchildren Natalie Olson and Tenley Malone, and great-great-grandchild Bennett Austin, and two sisters Dolores Mickelson and Deanna Macri. Marie was preceded in death by her husband Roy, grandson Walker Olson, and siblings Walter Schropp, Roger Schropp, Leona Cochran, Alice Nash, and Goldie Royston. Carlene Adams, age 90, of Monticello, passed away on Wednesday, May 27, 2020, in Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center following an extended illness. Private family services will be held on Saturday, May 30th, with interment in Oakwood Cemetery. Goesch Funeral Home of Monticello has taken Carlene and her family into their care. Please sign Carlene's guest book at www.goettschonline.com. Pastor Dave Ramish will officiate at the services. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Hillcrest Family Services via family. Surviving are her three children, Cindy Sue Adams Kell of Cedar Rapids, Stephanie Kettleson of Monticello, and Jeffrey Adams of San Diego, California. Four grandchildren, Stacy Sue Adams, Kell Dresser, Justin Michael Adams Kell, Joshua Eugene Kettleson, and Courtney K. Kettleson. A great-granddaughter, Olivia Sue Dresser, two sisters-in-law, Ruth Keel from Pekin, Illinois, and Betty Adams of Iowa City, and brother-in-law Don Chappelle of Manchester. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Jean, her sister Ruth Ann Winkler Chappelle, and brothers-in-law Glenn Adams, Don Keel, and Jim Kearns. Carlene Margaret Winkler was born February 11, 1930, at Monticello, Iowa. She was the daughter of Carl and Velma Schoon Winkler. Carlene graduated from the Monticello Community Schools with the class of 1948. Carlene Winkler and Eugene Adams were married on June 12, 1948, in the Little Brown Church at Nashua, Iowa. The couple farmed south of Monticello in Lovell Township. Carlene was a loving mother and homemaker. She loved spending time with her family. They were her life. She was a member of St. Matthew Lutheran Church, where she taught Sunday school and Bible school, served on the church council, and worked in her circle. She worked as a poll watcher during elections and was a campfire leader. She enjoyed card club and bowling with her friends in an afternoon league. Carlene will be greatly missed. Hazel Mae White, age 94 of Tama, passed away Thursday, May 28, 2020, at the Westbrook Acres Care Center in Gladbrook. A memorial graveside service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 3rd, at Oak Hill Cemetery in Tama. Hazel was born May 9, 1926, in Tama, Iowa, the daughter of Vince and Nada Hines. She attended country school and graduated from Tama High School in 1944. On May 8, 1950, she married Tom White at the Little Brown Church in Nashua, Iowa. They later divorced. Hazel worked in the Tama and Toledo area at the Beehive, Neil's Poultry House, Button Factory, McVee Grocery, and Meskwaki Bingo and Casino. She also worked at Kiowa in Marshalltown. Hazel was a member of the Fraternal Order of Eagles Auxiliary and belonged to horse clubs and the Pony Express. Hazel enjoyed bowling and crocheting. Survivors include one son, Sherman White of Toledo, three grandchildren, Mike Emerson, Shane White, and Patrick White, five great-grandchildren, Allison, Madison, Gina, Hunter, and Sarah, and four great-great-grandchildren, James, Grayson, Harper, and Hazley, three sisters, Betty Anderson of Keystone, Catherine Tigg Crossgree of Tama, and Nada Pink Rule of Tama, one brother, Tom Haynes of Tama, and several nieces and nephews. Preceding her in death were her parents, one son, Vince Cricket White, and two brothers, Irvin Haynes and Henry, as an infant. Memorials may be directed to Westbrook Acres in Gladbrook. Please feel free to leave condolences to the family at www.kruse-phillips.com. Josephine Abbott Smith Catalano was born on December 9, 1926, at Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, the daughter of Mary Ann Abbott and Nathan Arthur Smith. She died May 16, 2020, of natural causes. Jo graduated from Allegheny College with a bachelor's degree in speech and dramatic arts in 1948. She married Cosmo Anthony Catalano Sr. on September 4, 1948, in Metuchen, New Jersey. After moving to Iowa City in 1966, she worked at a local radio station and at the Johnson County Extension Office. Following her retirement in 1984, she volunteered at the Iowa City Public Library, the Iowa City Hospice, and the Trinity Episcopal Church. She was a member of the EOS. She also was a strong supporter of many performing arts organizations in Iowa City. She is survived by a daughter, Lee Arter Catalano of Portland, Oregon, and a son, Cosmo Catalano Jr. of Williamstown, Massachusetts. Her two grandchildren, Cosmo III and Margaret Josephine, and a great-grandson, Leo Ari Catalano. She was preceded in death by her husband and a daughter, Teresa Mary, also known as Tess. Her body has been donated to the University of Iowa Anatomy Department. A memorial service will be held at Trinity Episcopal Church at a future date. Memorial donations may be made to Iowa City Hospice, the Cosmo and Josephine S. Catalano Fellowship Fund at the University of Iowa Foundation, or Trinity Episcopal Church. Online condolences may be sent to the family at www.lensingfuneral.com. All right, and then shifting back to news, we have one more coronavirus-related article. Coronavirus pandemic zaps Iowa's tax collections. The coronavirus pandemic that hit Iowa last March will knock down expected state tax collections in Iowa by more than $500 million through June 2021, a state panel of economic experts projected Friday. Members of the State Revenue Estimating Conference lowered their forecast for tax collections by nearly $150 million in the current fiscal year that ends June 30th, and they revised their fiscal 2021 revenue expectations downward by about $360 million from levels they forecast March 12th. There's no economic model that accounts for a global pandemic or no recent history on how state, local, national, or global economies recover from a health crisis of this magnitude. We just don't know, said REC member Holly Lyons of the Legislative Services Agency. It's just an exceptionally uncertain, volatile, and even fearful time. Given that backdrop, REC members said they expect the state will collect $7.941 billion this year, this fiscal year, a 1% increase, or $82.4 million more than fiscal 2019. That compares to their original growth estimate of 3% and nearly $8.091 billion they set in March. In fiscal 2021, the year for which state legislators and Governor Kim Reynolds will formulate a spending plan when lawmakers reconvene Wednesday, REC members expect state revenue will slip by 0.8% to $7.877 billion, a drop of nearly $65 million from this fiscal year. The panel kept its 4.1% growth estimate for fiscal 2022, but the nearly $8.2 billion projection is now down $375 million from the March estimate made just as the virus was spreading into Iowa. REC Chairman David Roederer, head of the State Department of Management and Reynolds Budget Director, said Iowa is aided financially by strong reserves. Also, he said, the billions of dollars in federal funds being funneled to individuals, businesses, and government is helping the state weather the self-induced economic coma that was necessary to halt the novel coronavirus spread. I believe that, while bruised and somewhat battered, our fundamentals are still quite strong in this state, Roederer said in offering the most optimistic view of Iowa's economic future under an ongoing pandemic. Economically, I believe that we are on the upswing, he said. Toilet paper is back in stock, so I think this was the beginning of the recovery, roll by roll. The question is how fast will we recover and at what level? There's no economic model or what happens when a pandemic comes through and closes your economy. There's no model that says how we come out of it and how quickly we should bounce back. REC member David Underwood, a Clear Lake businessman, argued to set a far lower estimate of state tax collections, noting federal stimulus funds eventually will run out. I don't believe we reached the bottom, said Underwood, who worried the state could climb out of its economic doldrums only to fall back rather quickly if COVID-19 cases resurge. I'm not quite as optimistic for the recovery as either of you, but not terribly less optimistic, he said. We certainly aren't at any kind of normal today. Lyons said the real economic consequences of the pandemic are still unknown, and that's why she resisted a deeper reduction. I'm a little concerned about the message that we send, she said. There's enough fear and trepidation now out there. Friday's REC action likely lowered the state's projected fiscal 2020 surplus by $150 million to $390 million, while there is nearly $800 million in the state's cash and emergency reserves. When the pandemic began, the state budget had a large projected surplus and our reserve accounts were fully filled, said Representative Gary Moore, Republican of Bettendorf, chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. When we return to the Capitol next week, we will continue to budget in a cautious and conservative manner that funds our priorities in a responsible way. Majority Republicans have indicated they do not plan to use federal stimulus funds or state reserve accounts. All right, what do I need to do? I need to go to 55. What's in sports today? Sports. Now I think we have time for one sports article. Northern Iowa football, Panthers have high expectations. Northern Iowa football team's number 3 preseason ranking is yet another offseason confirmation of exceptionally high expectations for 2020. It's not difficult to understand why UNI is being pegged as one of the fall's best challengers for FCS stalwart North Dakota State. The Bison's 37-game winning streak and the NFL hype surrounding quarterback Trey Lance makes them as daunting as ever. But the Panthers returned 17 of their 22 starters, including 5 preseason Hero Sports All-American. UNI also stands to benefit from offensive coordinator Ryan Mahaffrey entering his second season at the helm. Mahaffrey returned to Cedar Falls last season after a 2-year stint as tight ends coach at Western Kentucky and helped guide the Panthers to the playoff quarterfinals and 10 wins amid a number of injuries in one of FCS's toughest schedules. Mahaffrey's play calling also helped quarterback Will McElvain break the single-season passing yards record by a freshman with 2,778. Headed into 2020 without the benefit of spring practices or on-campus off-season workouts because of the coronavirus pandemic, Mahaffey feels some comfort given the amount of experienced starters his offense returns. "We're excited to have a veteran team returning," Mahaffey said. "There are a lot of guys returning who have taken some meaningful snaps for us. Now it's about trying to figure out how do we build on the foundation we've created thus far." That foundation Mahaffey references likely starts with improving a running game that ranked 8th in the Missouri Valley Conference with 110.9 yards per game. Headed into the 2020 UNI's backfield, we'll have a pair of new weapons in Kansas grad transfer Dom Williams and highly regarded freshman Jalen Richardson out of Kansas City. That's an area of emphasis not just this season, but every season, evaluating what it is that we're doing in the run game. "Because you've got to be able to control the line of scrimmage," Mahaffey said. "The biggest thing that we're trying to do is to make sure we're streamlining what we do from a schematic standpoint, to make sure that our blocking unit, they feel comfortable with their ID, their looks, where those guys can rage off the ball and knock people back vertically off the line of scrimmage." Another factor bringing positive vibes is newly hired veteran offensive assistant and quarterbacks coach Sean Watson, who spent 2019 at Georgia as an offensive quality control coach. Coach Watson has done a great job coming in and sharing his wealth of knowledge and his experience to give us a fresh set of eyes on what we did last year, Mahaffey said. "We're going through it right now, making sure that we have consistent answers to some of the issues we were presented with last year." Mahaffey acknowledges that a lot of his time was spent this offseason evaluating his first season's body of work as offensive coordinator. But throughout all that hard work, he's enjoying the game that shaped his life as much as ever. "Whenever you get to self-scout, it's a fun time of year when you're able to sit back and evaluate yourself as a play caller," Mahaffey said. "We're able to evaluate each other as an offensive staff and recognize areas where we need to improve. The great thing about the game of football is it's always changing. Really, part of the fun is that you have to dig in and you got to find ways to be creative, but at the same time, be simple to allow your guys to execute." And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, May 30th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. Thanks for listening.